Welcome to Near Death Experience Podcast. I'm Chaz Hathaway. Today we're going to share the experience of one of our listeners, Cheryl Duran. She sent an email with her experience in it, and it's beautiful. So I'd like to share it today. In her message, she says, "Hi, Chaz. Thanks for the wonderful podcast. I listen every day and really love it. I thought I would share my own near-death experience with you. I had a NDE in 2014. I might add before I get started that I was an atheist or agnostic at the time. I had been suffering sleep apnea caused by a cyst in my throat, and one night I literally woke up outside my body. I did not see myself lying in the bed, as many do, but instead found myself sort of floating outside the sliding glass door of my bedroom. Several feet away from me stood a being. This being seemed very tall. If I had to guess, I would say 20 feet tall, either that or maybe I was just very small. This being was pure white and appeared to be wearing some sort of robe. I could not see a face, just a white hood. The entire being was lit up as though it had white neon lighting inside. I found myself being drawn towards it, and then I was held by it, as a mother would hold a baby. I felt no fear at all, and actually felt very comfortable and loved. I then noticed what looked almost like meteors in the distance. They appeared to be leaving the earth and heading towards space, a kind of fiery orange in color, like shooting stars, but going backwards. I got the impression that they might have been some sort of vehicle, possibly taking people from Earth. I don't know, but that was just the feeling I got. The next thing I remember was finding myself in the middle of a spinning vortex. It appeared dark in color with hues of blue, gray, and pink. The vortex appeared to have a cloudy texture, although I can't really be sure. As for me, I was not aware of having a body per se. I did seem to be contained to what would be the area of my body. I also felt very light. I would guess from feeling the heaviness of a flesh encasement. The most noticeable thing about being in this vortex was an incredible feeling of love. It was a different kind of love, which I cannot fully describe. A love with a different perspective than I would usually have. It was the kind of love that made me want to be kind and understanding of other human beings, actually giving me a different perspective of others. This was a sort of living love. It flowed all around me and through me. I also experienced a feeling of gratitude towards the Creator, God, whoever and whatever this vortex was and was connected to. I was then given a feeling. This feeling was transferred to me and washed through my body, or whatever I was. The feeling told me I needed to be more patient and loving with my son. I never heard any words. I just felt the feelings and knew what they meant. Towards the end of the experience, I saw off to one side sparks that looked like liquid gold. Along with seeing these sparks, I got a feeling like when you are a little kid and you are very relaxed and you're just gazing out the window and you feel very, very good. Well, that was the feeling I got, but more intense. I then found myself sitting up in bed, gasping horribly or painfully for air. It felt as though I had not breathed in some time. One thing I want to make sure I mention is that although I'm describing the physicality of the event, the physical and tangible part of the experience wasn't what was important at all. It wasn't about what I saw or heard or touched. It was really all about the emotion and feeling. During the experience, it's very hard to focus on what might be physical, so you are so drawn into the emotion of it. This experience definitely changed me and gave me a different view on how I should treat other people and more appreciation for their suffering and struggles in life. I also have more of an appreciation for myself. I definitely believe in the afterlife now. Thank you for the wonderful show, and please keep up the good work. Cheryl Duran. Thank you, Cheryl. What a beautiful experience, and very characteristic of experiences that I've heard, and yet incredibly unique, too. Beautiful in its content. I find it interesting. First off, you know, we'll just comb through this for all of our listeners, because there's so much to mention. Any who are familiar with sleep apnea will know that it's not uncommon to just stop breathing. And I want to comment on this for a few minutes, because there's a debate in the world about when actual death occurs. And it's really kind of funny hearing it from scientists and so forth, because it's so, you know, there's no line between when we die and when we don't die. It's like if you were a little bit better medically, you could bring them back, and there's never a point where there is no return, other than, you know, that our technology, our understanding, you know, there's a point where the doctor has to give up, because there's nothing more they know how to do that's going to be effective. And yet when you read near-death experiences, you find that line is, there is a line, in the sense that the moment the spirit leaves the body, that person is not experiencing the physical body anymore. Now, there is a little bit of a blur when the person is in the same space with their body, but they've become separated from their body. And I've spoken to people who talk about, in moments of medical crisis, they can feel themselves separating from their body. They may still be occupying the same area, but it's like the pop occurs, and then they can sit right up. It's like the link has broken, even if they're occupying the same space. And so there's that. But the moment that break happens, whether they're occupying the same space or whether they're separated from it, that seems to be the moment of death. And they could go in and out. And it's true that even in a coma situation, where the body is, you know, the heart is beating and breathing is happening, if the spirit leaves and is not feeling connected to the body, and sometimes there's a little bit of connection to the body in the sense that there's part of their attention that is always at the body, but sometimes they still go on and move on, even with the body doing its own thing. And so there is a blur, even in near-death literature and studies, about when death occurs. But I would just submit, as a simple definition of death, the moment that the spirit separates from the body to the point where they are detached from one another. You know, the spirit may still be aware of the body or something, but if it's not feeling anything or experiencing anything that the body itself is experiencing, I would call that death. And if the spirit comes back, then they are returned from death, and they're basically raised from the dead. Okay, and that happens in just about every one of these near-death experiences that we've shared, and so that's not unheard of. While the doctors, on the other hand, if they were to ask, did the person die, they would say, well, there's clinical death, and there's, you know, some kind of subjective death, and then there's relative death, and then there's the death where there's no return, and so forth. And they'll talk about those things, but it's because they don't have things to measure. Oh, there goes the spirit. It's just separated. And so it's understandable that that science can't say the moment the spirit separates from the body. But I think that's a fair definition of death. The moment the spirit separates from the body and is not feeling the feelings of the body anymore. And by that definition, if we can accept that definition together for a moment, if only for the sake of this discussion, then let's look at what are the things that seem to lead to death, meaning the separation of the spirit from the body. And in my experience, there are several things. I mean, obviously, you know, when people have, you know, a car accident and they're slammed against the whatever, they often just immediately leave their body. And so we don't know, did their heart instantly stop? Did their breathing instantly stop? We don't always know. But in hospital situations where they are being monitored and they are, you know, the life signs, the different brain activity, the breath and the heart beating and so forth, which things stop at the moment the spirit leaves the body, or which things stop that cause the spirit to leave, whichever way you want to look at it. And in my experience studying these things, it appears that the two most common causes or moments of the spirit leaving are either the stopping of breath or the stopping of the heart. Now, I say the moments, usually it's a few moments after. It's like when they're in the water, they try to take a breath and they can't get it, and there's a moment of pain or you know, this pinch or something, and then they're gone. Or, and gone meaning they, boom, they're out of their body. Or instantly they, boom, and they're feeling okay all of a sudden. They're like, wait a minute, I can breathe. And the other one is when the heart stops. And they usually have, oh, something's wrong, and then boom, and they're gone. It's seconds, you know. And in the situation of something like sleep apnea, where they're asleep at the time, the breathing stops, and there's a period of the body not quite recognizing yet that it hasn't been breathing, and then usually if it's a level of apnea where it's not, you know, seriously deadly, they, you know, the things in the body that say, you're not breathing, you know, kick in and wake the person up, you know, and they start breathing again. But sometimes those signals don't kick in fast enough to wake the person up before that moment of death occurs and the spirit pops from the body, which is one of the reasons that things that stop the breath quickly or stop the heart quickly usually are the most sudden near-death experience kinds of situations where the spirit leaves the body. And those are also often the situations where they're most revivable, because, you know, somebody who goes underwater and breathes in, boom, and they pass out. If you were to pull them out the moment they pass out and start pumping the water out of their body, they'll probably revive. That's one of the more resuscitatable situations. Whereas if somebody has a heart attack, that's a lot harder. You know, if they're found on the side of the road and they've been out for a minute and a half, it's going to be hard at that point, and so forth. And from a scientific point of view, there's a question, are they dead or have they just coded? But in my near-death studies, I'm seeing that coding is usually a moment of where the spirit is either about to or has already popped out of the body. And so when we talk about, you know, sleep apnea, this is a kind of a situation. I'm very interested in speaking with people with sleep apnea, because it's the breath. And the breath and the heartbeat are the two things that if they stop, either one of those stop, usually death occurs. Whether or not they come back, usually death occurs. And I suspect, and I don't have enough proof or evidence of this, but I suspect that even those who stop their breath enough to pass out and then are revived, I suspect that their spirit probably does pop out, but it stays in the same space long enough to pop back in. I don't know. I don't have enough evidence to call that a true hypothesis. That's just my guess. But they won't remember anything because they were just in this, you know, empty nothing, and they may not have been conscious through it. And sometimes there is a few moments of sleep, if you will, that the spirit is in a form of sleep where there's just not conscious memory for a short time. It's not usually very long, and usually in these fast kind of deaths of the stopping of breath or the stopping of the heart, there's usually no break in consciousness unless there's just like a blink. You know, they close their eyes and they open them back up, being in another realm. So this seems to be kind of like that. When Cheryl says that she's got sleep apnea, I'm immediately interested because I'm like, okay, breath is going, spirit's going. You know, that seems to be. And the cyst in the throat was probably just, you know, made that even more likely to occur, I guess you could say. She says, I literally woke up outside of my body. That sounds consistent because in sleep apnea, you're asleep at the time you stop breathing. And if you don't wake up before death occurs or the spirit leaves the body, that's exactly what is likely to happen. You're likely to wake up outside of your body. So she says, I did not see myself laying in the bed as many do, but I found myself sort of floating outside the sliding glass door of my bedroom. This seems very consistent. Also, most people who have left their body, if they're interested in their body, it's usually not until they notice it. And they're not likely to notice it unless they either look for it or they are taking note of other things, such as in a hospital room, they will find themselves floating in the corner of the room and they're like, oh, you know, this is very comfortable. You know, where am I? But I'm kind of curious, not really realizing that, not considering the fact that they, when they were in their body, came to the hospital, came to surgery or whatever. They're often just, you know, and sometimes they do. Sometimes when they came in intentionally, they're thinking, oh, I came into surgery, so I must be in this hospital somewhere or whatever. But often, you know, they wake up in the hospital because, you know, they had an accident, car accident, whatever. And so they're not even thinking about the fact that it would be them in the hospital. They're just in this hospital and they're like, oh, this is interesting. Who are these people? You know, look at that doctor, you know, they're working on someone. And then things like, the things that will make them notice the body are things like, they realize that they can sense the feelings and intentions of the people in the room. And they say, except for one. There's one person that I'm not getting anything from. Why am I not able to sense their presence as a fellow human being? And they look closer at the person, and it's the person lying on the bed, their dead body, which indicates that the body is not necessarily of any particular interest to the spirit, necessarily, unless there are other things such as attention to the fact that, oh my gosh, I have children, I can't leave now, things like that. It's, there's nothing about the body itself that necessarily feel that they feel drawn toward. And so they're much more likely to be drawn to the light or to some other thing that reflects love, reflects, you know, feelings and so forth, which is exactly what Cheryl is experiencing. She finds herself in front of this being that is incredibly tall. And this is something from near-death experiences I would love to learn more about. I don't get it. I don't know what to say about it, but it's very common. A very tall individual, people say 10 feet tall. She's saying 20 feet tall. And she says, or maybe I was very small. And it's hard to know because, I mean, here she climbs into this being's arms and is held like a baby in this being's arms. Could it be that she's in the form of a toddler or some small person and is in the presence of a 6-foot person, and, you know, proportionally they are looking 20 feet tall? I don't know. But it does seem that there are light beings on the other side, very commonly very tall. My guess is that it's probably somewhere in between for a couple of reasons. And again, this is totally my guess. If we had Cheryl in the room, we'd be able to get more clear answers from my ideas about this. But my guess is that she is taking on a smaller form, whether a body form or not. And we're going to talk about the body form that Cheryl seems to have in just a moment, but she seems to have a smaller form, and that this is probably a being who is very tall, 9 or 10 feet tall, maybe. I don't know. And again, when space and time and location are not really issues, size starts to break down too, you know, from a logical standpoint. You know, if time and space and distance and location really aren't major factors in, you know, the laws of spiritual physics, if you will, then of course there should be a breakdown in size difference. And so this could be a being, a grandparent or God or Jesus or something like that, and still be apparently 20 feet tall. That's not too far outside of the realm of possibility from the other things that we've learned about the spiritual realm. So anyway, regardless of whether this she's small and the being is tall, or whether she's the same size as she seems to sense, the, you know, it occupying the space of her body, and this being really is 20 feet tall, it's not really important. It's just very interesting. And then she says this being was pure white and appeared to be wearing some sort of robe. Now, I'm curious about these robes because they keep coming up. White robes, often covering heads, and sometimes, you know, beyond this hood is just a beam of light, so you can't even make out features. Other times, it's a person, just a full-on person. Sometimes it's even persons with slightly different features, such as somebody mentioned not having pupils. They had irises, but not pupils. What is that? I don't know. I suspect it was some kind of symbolic thing that they manifest for themselves because they were seeing more than just the visual or something. It was kind of a symbol of wisdom, maybe seership of sorts. I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, it sounds creepy when you hear it in these terms, and if you were to draw it, mortals would probably think, "Oh, that's creepy," because they are not surrounded by this feeling of love, absolute feeling of love. And so when you hear about a 20-foot hooded character, you know, this is a white hood, so you don't have to quite think, you know, Ghost of Christmas Future kind of thing. But this is a very loving being, and one that is emanating love, so we don't have to think of it as something creepy, even if the description seems different than what we might picture a loving angelic being in our mortal experience. Cheryl says that the entire being was lit up as though it had white neon lighting inside. I love that, white neon. If white could have neon, that could be a really cool description of the light from the other side. I found myself being drawn towards it, and then I was held by it as a mother would hold a baby. There's that spirit holding or being held like a baby again. I'm not sure what to make of that, but it keeps coming up, and it's so cool. I felt no fear at all, she says, and actually felt very comfortable and loved. I then noticed what looked almost like meteors in the distance. Now, this is cool, because I've heard of people seeing what looks like stars rushing by. And I guess that's another description. After all, a meteor is what we would call a shooting star. And so this is apparently like shooting stars shooting upward. And I wonder if others see it as meteors like that, or if they're just, you know, moving dots. It's not clear. You know, a meteor has this nice, beautiful tail. And that's what it sounds like she's seeing. And she gets the impression or the feeling like these may be some kind of vessels that people are being carried in. Now, the curious and you know, explorative part of me is kicking in here. And I think if you were to be a light being traveling through a tunnel towards the light, let's say people around the world that are dying, there are thousands every minute, you might say. I'd have to double check on those calculations, but based on the number of people alive today and how many are born, how many and so forth, I imagine that there are at least hundreds of people on the earth dying at any given minute. And so if you could see those from a spiritual eye so that you can see them, and they are beings of light rushing through tunnels, what would that look like? I mean, are we talking about noodles shooting up into space, or could we be talking about what looks like meteors in the distance? I don't know. That just occurred to me as we were talking about the meteors, you know, these tailed light something. I don't know. Just a thought. Anyway, and there is this sense many times when people are going through a tunnel or a vortex, as she describes, that they sense that there are other people around, but they don't necessarily see them or don't see, you know, the bodily forms of people. And she describes, saying, she says the vortex appeared to have a cloudy texture, although I can't really be sure. As for me, I was not aware of having a body per se. So I don't know if she looked down and so didn't see anything, but she says, I did seem to be contained to what would be the area of my body. So she still got this sense, and this is one of the senses that we actually have in mortality that we don't consider one of the five senses. If you study senses, as in the five senses and what other senses we have, one of them is this ability to recognize, like if you just stopped, closed your eyes right now, and then thought to yourself, without moving, thought to yourself, where in the space of my body, in this room, and so forth, where is my toe? You would pretty much know. And you could even reach it out to a space without being, you know, confused by it. In fact, the proof of that is in the idea that if you were to close your eyes right now and reach your toe out as far as you can without bumping anything, I think you could do it because you know where your toe is and you have a vague idea of what else is in the room just from being in the room. I think you could do it. And you haven't probably actively, consciously looked at your toe for at least, you know, 15 minutes or so, maybe, depending on what you're doing. But I know for myself, I was probably, when I put my shoes on a couple hours ago, was probably the last time I consciously thought about my toe. And yet I know where it is in the room. I know where it is in relation to the rest of my body. Not just because I know what my body is shaped like, but because I know where each part of my body is. It appears that Cheryl still has that. And even though she can't see her body, because she says, I'm not aware of having a body per se, she probably could have told you about the area around her where her finger would be if she had one. And so that sense still seems to be there. So there's a sense of having a body, and yet she doesn't seem to have one. And I assume visually, physically, she's not sensing it, but this sense of where different parts of her body are does still seem to be there. And she says, I also felt very light, I would guess from not feeling the heaviness of a flesh encasement. The most noticeable thing about being in this vortex was an incredible feeling of love. Okay, now before we go on to the love, I want to talk a little bit more about the body. We've talked in the past about the trifold nature of our being, our person. The body, which is the thing that we leave when we die. The spirit, which is that thing that as a spirit person, when you're seeing, they're seeing another being, that's what they're seeing. When they see, you know, when someone finds themselves in the spirit world and they're swimming, or they're, you know, some things that when they look at and they see hands, but maybe they're transparent, or maybe they look like they're made of light or whatever, they're seeing something there that feels like their body. It's just very light and they can fly and so forth like that. That is what I would call the spirit body. But there does seem to be this third thing that I call the conscious intelligence that is separate from the spirit and doesn't seem to have a visual representation except maybe light. It could be an orb of light, a ball of light, a beam of light, there's so many senses in this form and in the spirit form that the visual and physical aspects, the feel and the see, are just drowned out by these other sensations. And so, and there is a sense of something being there, and this, you know, emotional sense of this is a person here. And they'll even often see their grandma in this light form, or maybe not see them at all, but know that they're there and be communicating with their grandma. And they'll say they went to my left and then they went to my right or whatever. And yet there's nothing to see. And so all those other senses besides the visual and physical are telling them that that person is there, and it doesn't matter that there's not a visual representation. They're like, Grandma, it's so good to see you. And then only later in talking about it, they're like, wait a minute, I don't remember actually seeing her. That, to me, reflects this idea that the person was in the spirit. I mean, sorry, the conscious intelligence form. And again, I have to say this is just my own thoughts about it, because I haven't found anybody come back and say, I learned in my experience that there are three parts to our nature. I haven't found that to be the case. It's more that they're so excited to discover that they have a form outside of the body that they're not really noticing that sometimes they're in a spirit body, sometimes they're in the conscious intelligence form. Anyway, it appears that Cheryl is in this conscious intelligence form. I could be wrong, especially since she, excuse me, mentions that she does seem to be contained in what would be the area of her body. I'm not sure whether a conscious intelligence has this sense of body about them or not. I'd have to do some more research on that. But very interesting, very interesting. And then she talks about the love that she is feeling. She says the most noticeable thing about this vortex that she's in is the feeling of love. It was a different kind of love. She can't fully describe it. She says it's like having a different perspective than she usually has. I would use the word paradigm. I think she's in a different paradigm, one that she's maybe not familiar with. She's used to love from her life, but this is a new paradigm of love. And she says, I was then given a feeling. This feeling was transferred to me and washed through my body, or whatever I was. The feeling told me I needed to be more patient and loving with my son. I never had any words. I just felt the feelings and knew what they meant. Towards the end of the experience, I saw off to one side sparks that looked like liquid gold. I love this. I love this. I love this, because there are so many things that just we don't have the words for regarding near-death experiences. And when I hear descriptions that are like, I'm not sure how to picture that in my mind, I'm very grateful, because this is an attempt to do just that, to describe things that really can't be described, but we have to try. We have to try, because it's the only way we're going to be able to bring what's going on the other side and the feelings of the other side to this side, is to just keep trying to give these descriptions in whatever wording we can give. And then as we do, we'll start coming up with new words and new concepts and new terms. And I'd like to talk about that if we get time here at the end, about coming up with new words for things, because we're getting enough listeners that we can work on this together and help to form a new vocabulary that can be helpful in describing some of these things. So I want to say, don't let me forget to come back to that. But since this is, you're listening in the future, anyway, if I don't bring it up again, send me a message and say, hey, you forgot to mention this. Okay. Because I do want to talk more about this. Okay, so she goes on and she says that she's filled with this feeling that is akin to the idea of being a child, just being relaxed and just gazing out the window and feeling very, very good. And yet she says, well, that was the feeling I got, but more intense. And I want to talk about that some more too. But at this point, she suddenly finds herself sitting up in bed, gasping horribly and painfully for air. So she's just like slapped back into her body, just whack, you're back in. And she says that although I'm not, I am describing the physicality of the event, the physical and tangible part of the experience wasn't what was important at all. So she's having these physical sensations, and yet that's not what this was about. That's not what this was about at all. It's almost as if, you know, we kind of picture, and I'm kind of thinking this might be partly what she's trying to say, that we kind of picture being in this painful, very tangible body and so forth, and then we're swept away into this light, gentle, you know, place and so forth. And then we're slammed back in the body, and it's painful and it's hard and so forth. I almost get the impression that it's kind of the other way around, that she is experiencing this, you know, terrible, you know, well, she's in the body and she just falls asleep, whatever. And then she's wham, and she's in this, you know, intense, loving experience that's just overpowering. And then when she gets back in her body, it's just pain, and it's just ouch, and it's like breathing and so forth. It's like the intensity of life has just been deadened back down to this low physical form again. I could be wrong. Maybe I'm putting words in her mind, but in her mouth. I hope not. But she says that although I'm describing the physicality of the event, the physical and tangible part of the experience wasn't what was important at all. That's not what it was about. You know, it's almost like the physical stuff was an afterthought. It's just like, oh, by the way, you're probably wondering, you know, what was happening physically. It's like, well, this is what was happening, but that's not what this is about. That spiritual side, that emotional side, the emotions, my goodness. She says it was really all about the emotion and the feeling. It was really hard to focus on the physical, she says, because you're so drawn to the emotion of it. And even when she describes the communications that she had, or the information that she felt she was given, it was almost more as if it was emotion with a little, you know, tag of communication as well. It's like the communication was the emotion. That's what the message was. And yet, if you had to translate it into English, which doesn't have emotion as part of its vocabulary, you'd have to say, well, it was, you know, it was saying this, and so forth. And so I think that's also one of the reasons that this is challenging to describe. And so what an incredible experience. And she says it gave her a whole new perspective, such that it changed her life. She says, this experience definitely changed me and gave me a different view on how I should treat other people and more appreciation for their suffering and strugglings in life. That is just beautiful. So, and she also has a greater appreciation for herself, which is beautiful. That's what I'm finding about this message of love. Are we talking about the love of God, the love that God has for us, a love of ourselves, a love for other people? And the answer is yes. Yes, yes, and yes. It's all about all of that, because it's all one thing. And because of that greater understanding and compassion, you're going to have more appreciation and love for yourself. You're going to have more appreciation and love for your neighbor, for your son, for those who you don't even know who are suffering. You're going to have a better appreciation for them. So thank you so much, Cheryl, for sharing this experience. This is beautiful. I would like to go back and talk for a few minutes about language for a minute, okay? Because this is something that is lacking in near-death experience, not that it's not known. I mean, it's very well known that we're lacking in language, but we need terms that can carry entire packages of ideas, because when we're talking about the ineffable and we're trying to describe it such that people who haven't experienced it may get some level of understanding about it, we've got to find terms to try to find, to be able to communicate this stuff. Because unfortunately, we're all mortal. And unless you've had this kind of experience, you don't have the background to be able to say, well, it was like this. So let's work on coming up with some terms. Okay, so for example, and forgive me if you've heard me talk about this before. I think I have on the podcast, but it's been a while. And I think it's worth bringing up so we can, you know, get people thinking along these lines of coming up with words for ideas and feelings and thoughts that are generally considered ineffable. So I've found all, you know, throughout my life, just a fascination with, you know, when you're driving down the street at night, maybe in a suburb or, you know, a quiet neighborhood or something, and you can see somebody's got their living room curtains open, so you can see into the living room. There's nobody in there. Maybe they're just sitting there watching TV or something, and you're just getting this quick glimpse into their house at night. And I think it works. I don't know what it is about night that causes this feeling more than during the day, but you know, you just glance over and you see this house, and there's somebody, or there's you know, this life going on in there, whether there's people inside or not. It's just this world in there that I'm not a part of, and yet I see it, and it's fascinating to see. And there's this feeling that I often get when I see that. And that's, I use that as an example of when I get the feeling, but this feeling of not wanting to be there per se, because I don't. I probably want to be where I'm going to at the time, but a feeling of almost like a curiosity, longing for something just beyond what I can see. I don't know what it is. It's like I'm sensing this little universe that this family has in this house, and I can sense that being there, and yet I can't be there. And even if I were, it would break the feeling. It wouldn't, you know, create more of it. It would just, you know, break it. But seeing it there and feeling that, it feels kind of cool. And I've looked up different feelings, and the closest thing that I can find is either wistful or nostalgic, but they don't capture it. You know, nostalgia often has kind of sad connotations, or, you know, a sense of kind of being in the negative emotions a little bit. And then wistful is kind of like, oh, you know, a little bit, I don't know, substanceless a little bit. And I was talking to my family about this one day, and we were talking about this idea of forming words. We weren't talking about near-death experiences or anything, but among other things, dreams, because you know how you'll have a dream and you try to describe it to somebody, and they're like, and you're like, well, but it felt just, I don't know how to describe it. And we were talking about this idea of things that are very difficult to describe, so let's come up with words for things. And I was trying to describe this to them, and they started saying, yeah, I kind of get something like that when I look out, you know, like at sunset over a forest or something. And I'm like, yes, that's another situation where you feel it. And it's not necessarily this longing to be there, but that there's something beyond the surface that you can't see that's beautiful, and you can just sense it there, you know, or that there's something just out of reach. And yet, if you were there, it wouldn't necessarily mean that you'd, you know, feel more of that feeling. It's like that reaching kind of nostalgic, wistful something or other that's kind of, I don't know, you know. And they started talking about it, and we kind of came to terms, okay, we need a name for this feeling that we have. And because, you know, it's the closest two words that we could come up with, we decided to mix wistful and nostalgia. Not because it's, you know, a combination of those emotions, but those are just the closest two that we can think of, and so we decided to call it wistalgia. And this feeling of wistalgia that you get in these situations, sometimes looking at a sunset, sometimes, you know, and, you know, because you can look at something and appreciate its beauty. You know, if I were to walk into a room and see this beautiful room, beautiful, artwork and just I'd be like, wow, this is a beautiful room. I don't necessarily get the feeling of nostalgia, but looking out over a sunset, I may get it. And looking over something that's just a beautifully gorgeous, decorative something, I can get it from something decorative. I'm just less likely to. I'll sometimes get it from art. But anyway, so we decided to call it Wistalgia. And the reason I bring this up as an example is because since inventing that word, I label it every time I feel it. For example, I feel it when I look out at night over that orange amber street light when it's shining down on either a tree or a person or a bench or something. Just looking at it and just kind of concentrating on it a minute, I'll be filled with this nostalgia and I'll be like, oh, there it is. That's nostalgia. Okay. And since labeling it, I've noticed it more. And I've found that I can feel it more often since I've labeled it. There's something about words. Putting a word to something gives it power and gives it potency that it didn't have before. I don't know why it is, but you can talk to linguists and science people, scientists, and they will tell you that when you place words on things, you are able to communicate things better, and therefore new ideas are born. And I think that's kind of what's happening. And so I'm finding that I feel different kinds of nostalgia. There are nostalgias, like the sunset, where it's just like, ooh, I just want to be in there, in that those colors in the clouds. I just want to be among them. And yet I can't, obviously. So there's that longing kind. There's a nostalgia that comes from seeing an old corroded factory, in at twilight or, when those night lights come on, that I would not even want to be near it. And yet there's still some kind of dark nostalgia about it that is just like, ooh, this dark alley kind of a feeling that there's still this strange draw toward it that is... I don't know. It's almost like this primal curiosity mixed with longing, mixed with repulsion a little bit. And yet there's something kind of beautiful about it, and I'm trying to give these descriptions in words that we don't have. And that's the point, is that let's come up with words for things. Let's come up with, for example, we in near-death literature, we've come up with the word life review. And the moment you say life review, those of us that have been studying it or listening to these podcasts or listening to other programs about it know exactly what you're talking about. And there are different flavors of life review. There's different kinds. There's some where you experience this, ripple effect out to the 30th degree. And then there's others where it's just a few flash images from the life. But we get it. We know what we're talking about because we've come up with a term for it. And now we can talk about different kinds of life reviews and different terms for different types of life reviews. So, the term nostalgia, I want to submit that out there because I think I sensed it. I think I sensed it here when Cheryl is talking about, she says, along with seeing these sparks, I got a feeling like when you're a little kid and you're very relaxed, and you're just gazing out the window and you feel very, very good. When I first read that, I'm like, oh, she felt nostalgia. A type of nostalgia, at least. One of the branches of nostalgia that we need. That feeling of just like, oh, it's beautiful. Or, oh, this just feels good. I just want to be right where I am, right now, seeing what I'm seeing. Which is another kind. It's like not longing to be there, like the sunset kind, but the kind of just like, wow, just this is where I am. There's an awe aspect to it and so forth. I think there's nostalgia in that. And having that word to work with, we could say, was it a longing nostalgia? Was it a presence nostalgia, just wanting to be where you are? Is it, and we can get more detailed about it. in our descriptions when we have terms for it. And so I love this idea. Another word that that we came up with, my family and I came up with, was dream flash. Or, yes, a dream flash. That's it. It doesn't have to be dreams, but dreams are just the most common and easily describable example of it. And it's this idea that, you know, you'll be walking along or doing something, and just something, you could almost call it deja vu, but it's more like a deja vu of the past, something of the past that happened, you know, that something reminded you of something, and you're just like, but the moment it's there, it's also gone. And so it's like, oh, I remembered my dream last night, but now I forgot it again in an instant. You know, it's like a flash of, oh, the dream, it's gone. I can't, you know, and it's gone. I call that a dream flash. And I've had it, you can have dream flashes regarding words that you've been trying to think of, you know, that are on the tip of your tongue, and then it's there and then it's gone. Dream flash of the word. I just had a dream flash of the word, you know, or maybe something that you're trying to remember, or a person. I get crazy dream flashes watching movies with actors that I'm like, I know where I've seen them before, but I can't think of what it is. And I'll be like, that person's familiar at first. I'm like, I know I've seen them in a movie. And then halfway through the show, I'll get this dream flash of where I saw them. But by definition, it's instantly gone again too. And so it's like, wah, ooh, where is that from? Where is that person from? Where did I see them? And I'll have dream flash. And then they'll come more often until suddenly, bam, it sticks. And so, you know, the idea of a dream flash. And I think this is something that's useful for near-death literature, because people will have dream flashes of experiences they've had. And it just like the experience of, you know, having the dream flash, and then it comes full on, and you're like, oh, I know it. It's so-and-so from this movie, and I can tell you all the parts where they, what they said, what they did. It's all there all of a sudden. That movie is like the experience that people are having, you know, who have had near-death experiences but have forgotten them. And then they have little things, maybe a flash of light or something, the way somebody says something, or a feeling that they have, you know, in a loving situation. And they're like dream flash of their experience. But they're like, what was that? I felt, it's like a memory, but no, it's gone. It's gone. That's a dream flash. I would call that a dream flash. And I think it's a useful word for this kind of thing. And I can't say necessarily that I've had any dream flashes of what seemed to be some kind of near-death experience, because part of the problem with not having had a near-death experience is that I don't know what it is that I'm looking for in terms of feelings and sense. You know, it's like, I know, full of love, full of joy, and full of, you know, telepathic communication, but what does that even feel like? I don't have the experience to know what that feels like. It's like trying to describe to a child what being in love, really being deeply, madly in love with somebody is like. You could say, well, it's kind of like a crush, but it's more than that. It's more than that. And they're like, you know, and there's a physicality to it. And there's wanting to, your personalities to merge into the same person and so forth. And it's hard to describe that to a child because they don't have the experience. Those of us who haven't had a near-death experience don't quite know what it is that we're looking for in order to know if we've had dream flashes of experiences we've had, or memories of before this life, which some people do get. They'll get flashes of before they came to Earth. And it's rare, but it happens. And sometimes when people have a near-death experience, they will later have dream flashes of previous experiences or pre-Earth life experiences. It's like, now that they know what they're looking for, now that they know their body and mind know what it feels like to experience that, then when they have the dream flash, they can cling to that a little bit. Anyway, I would like to hear from you guys what kinds of things need words, okay? Especially if you've had an experience, what kinds of descriptions need words, or terms for them, that we can take a whole, you know, podcast to describe what it is, or a whole, you know, page of writing to describe what it is, and then we can tell people this is what it is. And then as they see that, they're like, okay, you know. And then when they experience it, they're like, oh, this kind of, yeah, that's what I experienced. And so they start using that word too. And they start, others start using that word too. Pretty soon we have this word and we can expand on it. Because to say a comprehensive life review will tell you a lot. And to say a quick little life review says a lot too. And because you're familiar with the word life review, you can understand what that might be like. Whereas if we didn't have the word life review, I would have to give you, you know, multiple paragraphs of description of what that is. So let's come up with some words. I want to hear from you guys and what things need words, whether it seems to be descriptive of near-death experiences or not. Let's come up with some more words to work with because we are part of a unique community that is aware of things that are just ineffable. And because they're ineffable, by definition, they don't have words for them. So let's start trying to come up with words. And as we do, we can mold them into descriptors that can be used to help us all communicate this, the experiences that people are having and that we are having. You can do that by doing the same ways that we encourage you to contact the podcast, by emailing neardeathexperiencepodcast@gmail.com. We can do it by you calling 970-NDE-CAST and talk about your idea or your word, whatever, you know. And if you, you know, whether you say, I have a great word for this thing that you keep mentioning, or you say, I have something that needs a word, whatever, you know, we'll take it all. And let's come up with, you know, some of this. And if we get enough discussion about it, we could start a Facebook group to discuss different ideas and so forth. And it sounds gimmicky on the surface when you just talk about, you know, coming up with words for things. But what I learned from inventing that word wistalgia is that you put words on things and they start expanding. And they become bigger, and they become more comprehensive, and there's more to be said about them. So, again, you can email or call the podcast. And if you would like to support the podcast, we are getting close to $50 at this point, so a little bit more, we'll put it at $50, at which point I will begin to record an extra episode every week to put on the Patreon page. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/NDEcast. If you can't support, don't feel bad. Don't feel bad. I'm just happy that you're here. And I want to thank you, all of you, so much again for listening.